Chapter 38. Reacher and Chang used the decorative path past the plantings, between the solar lights, through the gate and into the backyard. They saw a broad rectangle of spectacular desert landscaping, with wood arbors and climbing vines for shade, and huge terracotta pots and fallen amphorae spilling out with flowers, and stately saguaro cactuses standing alone in gravel beds. They saw a swimming pool made of dark plaster, shaped like a natural pond edged with rocks and fed by small, splashing waterfalls. They saw teak furniture, richly oiled with fat, colorful cushions and sun umbrellas and outdoor dining tables. They saw about 40 people, men and women, some young, mostly older, some dressed in bright Arizona clothes, some in bathing suits, some in cover-ups, all clustered in groups, talking, laughing, clutching plates and glasses. Some were wet, and there were others still in the water, ducked down neck deep and talking or floating or horsing around. At a table under a vine was a young woman of about 30, long and lithe and golden tan, in a thin shirt over a bikini, relaxed and smiling, but luminous, and in some unstated but obvious way, the center of attention. Behind her on one side was a man, gray-haired but well-preserved, wearing khaki shorts and a loud Hawaiian shirt, and behind her on the other side was a dark-haired woman with bright eyes and a wide smile, wearing an ankle-length shift made of pale linen. The familiar ease between the three of them made it clear this was a daughter and her parents, and the old Google image seen on Chang's phone made it clear the parents were Dr. and Mrs. Evan Lair. Reacher pointed discreetly and said, "Check that out." There was a long table set up near the house, and it was stacked with gifts, most of them large and boxy, all of them wrapped and ribboned in monochrome whites and silvers. Chang said,
"This is a wedding."
"Looks like it," Reacher said. "They're daughters, presumably. The girl at the table, I guess she's McCann's niece."
Then McCann's sister was on the move. After a last laugh and smile and affectionate squeeze of her daughter's shoulder, she drifted from group to group, chatting, sparkling, leaning in, smiling, kissing, having the time of her life. Chang said,
"She hasn't heard from Chicago yet. How could she have?"
Reacher said nothing. McCann's sister moved on, group to group, taking a glass from a passing tray, putting her hand on other people's arms, putting the glass back on another tray. Then she caught sight of Reacher and Chang standing alone and awkward near the gate, underdressed in terms of quality, overdressed in terms of quantity, unknown and unexplained. And she changed course and headed toward them, still smiling, eyes still bright, a happy hostess's welcome all over her face. Chang whispered,
"We can't tell her. Not now."
The woman came close and extended a slim and manicured hand. She said,
"Have we met? I'm Lydia Lair."
She looked like her Google picture at the charity ball, like $1 million. Chang shook her hand and gave her name, and then Reacher did, and the woman said,
"I'll ask you the same question I've been asking all afternoon, which is, do you know our daughter from school or from work? Not that it makes the slightest bit of difference, of course. It's all one big party, but it's something to say."
Reacher said,
"Ma'am, we're here for something else entirely. Perhaps we should come back later. We wouldn't want to crash a wedding. Might bring 7 years of bad luck."
The woman smiled.
"I think that's mirrors," she said. And this isn't the wedding. Far from it. Not yet. This is a kind of pre-wedding breakfast, bride-side-only party sort of thing. So people can start to get to know each other ahead of the rest of the week's events, so everyone gets energized for the big deal at the weekend. My daughter says everyone does it now. But you know how it is these days. The weddings last longer than the marriages.
And then she laughed, a happy sound, as if certain her joke didn't apply to her, as if certain her daughter's marriage would last forever. Chang asked,
"Would this evening be more convenient? May I know what it's about?" "Your brother, Peter." "Oh, dear. I'm so sorry, but I think you might have wasted a trip. He isn't here. He didn't come. We expected him, obviously, but it's a long flight." "How do you know Peter?" "We should get into that later this evening, if that's convenient, because right now we're holding you up, and we've taken far too much of your time already. We should let you get back to your guests."
McCann's sister smiled appreciatively and started to turn away, but a new thought struck her, and she turned back, different. She said,
"Is Peter in trouble? Are you police officers?"
Chang did the only thing she could, as a woman with a code, which was to ignore both questions completely and respond with a statement that resembled an answer. She said,
"We're private investigators." "Did Kiever send you?" "Ma'am, now we really need to talk, but we can't pull you away from all of this. Is Peter in trouble?"
Chang did the same thing again. She said,
"Ma'am, we're here to be briefed. Our job is to hear about Peter from you."
McCann's sister said,
"Come with me."
They walked through the house to a dark paneled study, shuttered tight against the sun, with club chairs and a Riverstone fireplace. They sat down, the women perched almost knee to knee, Reacher leaning back. McCann's sister asked,
"Where should I begin?"
Reacher said, "Tell us what you know about Kiever."
"I never met him, obviously, but Peter likes to talk things through, so during the selection process I felt I got to know all the candidates to some extent."
"How many candidates were there?"
8, to start with."
"Did the process take long?"
"Almost 6 weeks."
"That's thorough."
"That's Peter."
"How often do you talk?"
"Most days."
"How long are the calls?"
"Some days an hour."
"That's a lot."
"He's my brother. He's lonely."
"Why did he need a private detective?"
"Because of Michael, his son, my nephew."
"People say there are issues."
"That's the wrong word. That's a polite way of saying difficult, which is already a polite way of saying something worse. Michael is the opposite of difficult."
"What would be the right word?"
"Michael didn't make it all the way to the end of the assembly line. A couple of things didn't get bolted on. I try not to blame the mother, but she wasn't well. She died less than 10 years later."
"Which things got missed?"
"Are you a happy man, Mr. Reacher?"
"Can't complain. Generally speaking, right now I feel pretty good. Not in relation to the current part of our conversation, you understand."
"On a scale of 1 to 10, what's the worst you've ever felt?"
"About a 4.
"And the happiest?"
"Compared to the theoretical best ever?"
"I suppose."
"About a 9.
"Okay. 4 at the bottom and 9 at the top. What about you, Miss Chang?
She didn't answer right away. Then she said,
The worst I've ever felt would be a 3, and I was going to say 8 for the best, but now maybe 9, I think.
She looked at Reacher as she said it, in a certain way, and McCann's sister caught the glance. She said,
Are you two sleeping together?
No response.
Honey, if you're sleeping together, make it a 9 for sure. Always safer, but no higher. 10 gives them performance anxiety. But right now, between the two of you, we have a swing from either 3 or 4 at the low end to a pair of 9s at the high end, even though one of the 9s is really an 8, but we're too polite to say so. But you get my drift. You're normal people. If you swung from 2 to 7, you'd still be normal, but you'd be seen as a little doer and reserved. Understand?
Chang nodded.
Now, suppose your needle is jammed on 0. Doesn't move at all. 0 at the bottom and 0 at the top. That's Michael. He was born unhappy, born without the capacity to be happy, born without any concept even of what happiness is. He doesn't know it's there.
Chang said,
Is there a name for that? They have names for everything now. Peter and I discuss them endlessly. None of them really fits. I like an old-fashioned vocabulary. I think of it as melancholy, but that sounds too weak and passive. Michael has depth of emotion, just not range. You feel joy or passion, and he feels the same intensity, but it's all hammering away down at the 0 level. And he's intelligent. He knows exactly what's happening to him. The result is endless torment. How old is he now?
He's 35.
What are the outward signs? Is he hard to get along with?
The opposite. You hardly know he's there. He's very quiet. He does what you tell him. He hardly speaks. He sits for days staring into space, chewing his lip, his eyes, darting around. Or else he's on his computer, or fiddling with his phone. There's no aggression. He never gets upset. Upset would imply an emotional range.
Can he work?
That's been part of the problem. He has to work to qualify for housing. It's part of the deal. And he can work. There are things he's good at. But people find him draining. They don't like to be with him. Productivity goes down. Usually he's asked to leave, so he's in and out of the programs.
Where does he live now?
Right now? Nowhere. He went missing.
At that point, the bride-to-be came in, looking for her mother, a thin shirt over her bikini, Peter McCann's niece, Michael McCann's cousin. Up close, she was still luminous. She glowed. She was close to perfect. Prenatal care, perinatal care, postnatal care, pediatrics, nutrition, education, orthodontics, vacations, college, postgrad, a fiancé, the whole 9 yards. Her assembly line had worked just fine. The American dream, a spectacular result.
And she looked happy.
Not silly, not giggly, not hyped up, and not an airhead, just deeply and serenely content, with room at the top for ecstasy. Her needle ran from maybe 6 to 10. She had gotten everything her cousin hadn't.
McCann's sister went back out to the pool with her. She promised to return as soon as she could. Reacher and Chang sat quiet in the darkened den. They heard the sounds of the party, muted by walls and distance,
splashes and yelps and the clink of glasses and the rolling murmur of conversation. Chang said,
"We should call Westwood in L.A. We should update him. A deal's a deal. Plus, we're going to need another hotel."
Reacher said, "Tell him we need everything he has on the deep web, all his notes. Or maybe tell him to come out here to explain it all in person. We might not understand his notes. He can get on a plane. He's getting the book deal."
Chang put her phone on speaker and dialed, and she gave the guy the play-by-play. Everything that had happened since she last called from the West Hollywood Motel. She mentioned Chicago, the library, the mom-and-pop pharmacy, McCann's Street, McCann's house, Hackett, the neighbor, the Lincoln Park homicide, the flight to Phoenix, and finally the sister. And then the son, in the long term, trapped between zero and zero, and in the short term, missing. Westwood said, "They call it anhedonia, the inability to experience pleasure."
"The sister makes it sound worse than that."
"And Kiever's job was to find him and bring him home?"
"We assume so. We didn't get that far in the story. We were interrupted."
"I don't see how the deep web or 200 deaths are involved. This feels like the crime desk, not the science desk. Or one of those human tragedy stories."
"It could be all three. We don't know yet."
"Where are you staying?"
"We haven't figured that out."
"Okay.
I'll call you when I land."
The line went dead. Reacher said, "Apparently Michael spends time on his computer or fiddling with his phone. Maybe that's the deep web connection. Maybe he's in some weird kind of chat room all the time. Maybe he has a whole life no one else knows about."
"He's depressed, not weird."
"Depressed means what it says, which is pushed down below the normal position, which implies a range, which Michael doesn't have, which is weird, or unusual, to be polite. But he's intelligent," she said. "Maybe there are support groups online. Maybe he started one."
"Why would it need to be secret?"
"Because of search engines, I guess. Employers check online. I read about it in the newspaper. And not just employers, probably. Probably all kinds of people. Relatives, possibly. Or doctors. There's no privacy anymore. Things can come back to bite you. If Michael posted something that showed he wasn't making progress, he could lose his housing. Or someone might decide he needed supervision."
Then the door opened and Lydia Lair came back in. Peter McCann's sister, Michael McCann's aunt, and the mother of the bride. She sat down in the same chair and Reacher asked her, "How did Michael go missing?" She said,
"That's a long story."
20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair took the call on his landline. His contact said,
"This is your screw-up now."
"In what way?"
"There were things you didn't know."
"What things?"
"I promised you they wouldn't talk to McCann, and I delivered. Can't talk to a dead man. But it came at a cost. I lost Hackett."
"How?"
"Reacher took him out. Or both of them together. Either way, it shouldn't have happened. Not theoretically possible."
"Is he dead?"
"He's in the hospital."
"Are you going to let them get away with this?"
"No, I'm not. I'm going to make an example. This is an image business. Very competitive. Brand strength is everything. So I'll split it with you. 50-50.
"Split what?"
"The cost of not letting them get away with it."
The man with the jeans and the hair paused a beat And then he said, "You didn't let them talk to McCann, for which you have my grateful thanks. It was a job well done. But with respect, that concluded our business. Any feelings you retain for Reacher or Chang are now personal to you, surely." Hackett is handcuffed to the hospital bed. He's in police custody.
How much does he know?
Bits and pieces. But they won't prove anything. Hackett has no evidence with him. No data. Reacher stole his phone, and he left his computers in the car, which was provided by our friends in Chicago, complete with a driver. So we still have his hardware. We fired up the phone sniffer again. Chang is back on the air. She just called the guy at the LA Times, from a suburban location right here in Phoenix.
Why there? Because of you? Are they coming for you?
Richard called me on Hackett's phone and told me so. Plus, it would be an easy prediction anyway. But not if you listen to Chang's call to the LA Times. They're here for a completely different reason altogether.
Which is what?
There were things you didn't know.
What things?
The kind of things that will make you happy to split with me 50-50.
Tell me.
Peter McCann had a sister, Lydia McCann, as was, now Lydia Lair, married to a doctor. She lives here in Phoenix, in a suburban location. The brother and the sister talked all the time. He told her everything. According to what Chang just said to Westwood, it could be that talking to the sister is the same thing as talking to McCann himself.
We can't let that happen.
We?
Okay, 50-50.
Of course. I'm glad we see eye to eye.
But with one extra thing.
Which would be what?
Tell me how McCann died.
Hackett shot him.
In greater detail.
Hackett went to visit him very early in the morning and walked him out of the building at gunpoint, to the local park. There was no one around. He shot him in the back of the skull with a silenced 9.
Was there a lot of mess?
I wasn't there.
Probably exited through the face, but the brain was dead by then. No further heartbeat, no blood pressure. Effective, but not visual.
Are you going to do the same thing with Reacher and Chang? I'm going to do whatever the hell works. Split 50-50. Which could be expensive. Because apart from anything else, we also have to do it fast. They could be talking right this minute.
Chapter 39. The long story about Michael McCann's disappearance began with a desire to visit Oklahoma. Michael announced it one day, in his slow, halting, disappointed way, and his father didn't let himself fall in the trap of worrying about it. Not then, not immediately, because he knew it was unlikely to happen. These things rarely did. But then Michael further announced he had researched housing policy in Oklahoma, which was different from Illinois in that part-time work could qualify, which might be more sustainable. Peter McCann's reaction had been mixed. Obviously, at the top of the pole was the sheer terror of imagining Michael alone and adrift in an unfamiliar environment. But underneath that was a tiny green shoot of optimism. Finally, Michael had spent some computer time productively. He had researched housing policy in another state. He had even drawn a conclusion, which might be more sustainable, which was almost like making a plan. Certainly, it showed a solid flicker of initiative. It was evidence of self-motivation, which some long-ago shrink had said would be the first sign of improvement. So all in all, Peter McCann had been holding it together. His sister said,
"Then Michael announced he had a friend in Oklahoma, which was a big deal. He had never had a friend before. He had never even used the word. We figured it happened through an internet forum, which was worrying, I guess. But Michael is 35 years old. He's not retarded. His IQ is way up there. He knows what he's doing. He's sad, that's all." So Peter asked what questions he could and then bit his lip.
Reacher said, "And what happened?"
"Michael went to Oklahoma, a little place not far from Tulsa. He texted at first, then less frequently, but he was okay as far as we knew. Then one day he texted to say he was coming home soon. He didn't say exactly when, and he didn't say why. We haven't heard from him since."
"When did Peter call the police?"
"Pretty soon afterward. Then he called everybody."
"Including the White House?"
"I advised him not to, but of course no one anywhere was listening to him. There are 500,000 mentally challenged homeless men in America. No one would consider searching for an individual among them. How could they? Why would they? Michael is not aggressive, and he isn't on medication. He isn't dangerous."
"Didn't they at least check with the friend?"
"I'm sure you know how it is. In your own jobs, suddenly all you have is a name that doesn't mean much and a hazy, half-remembered address no one can find."
"So the friend has not been identified?"
"No one even knows whether it was a man or a woman."
"What about the social housing?"
"There wasn't any. Clearly, Michael had been staying with the unknown friend. Probably not working at all, even part-time."
"And then what happened?"
"Obviously, Peter wouldn't give up. He went to work on his own. First, he got help from the phone company. He can be very persistent. They tracked Michael's phone. The last day they can see it move southwest from one cell tower to the next, from around Tulsa to Oklahoma City, at what looks like an average speed of about 50 miles an hour, which was a bus, Peter thinks. He thinks Michael took the bus from Tulsa to Oklahoma City."
"Why?"
"To get the train to Chicago."
Reacher nodded. "The train. Inevitably." Chang said,
"There are other trains out of O.C.
McCann's sister said,
"Peter thinks Michael was coming home. Peter's certain of it. And sure enough, at first the phone moves north in the right direction at the right speed, but then it switches off. Because it got too far away, we had the same thing. The last cell tower is about 90 minutes north of Oklahoma City. Then you're in dead air forever. It never came back on again."
"Did Peter tell the cops?"
"Of course."
"What did they say?"
"They say the phone hunted for a signal so hard it ran down the battery. Then Michael didn't get a chance to charge it before it got stolen in Chicago. Just because he hasn't visited his dad doesn't mean he isn't back in town. And so on and so forth. Or alternatively, the phone was stolen in Tulsa, or O.C. and some other guy took it on the bus and the train, but he didn't have the code to unlock the screen, so he quit trying and trashed it. Meanwhile, Michael is still in Oklahoma. Or perhaps he went somewhere else entirely, possibly San Francisco."
Reacher said, "Why San Francisco?" McCann's sister said,
"There are a lot of homeless men in San Francisco. Cops think it's a magnet. They think people go there automatically, like it's still 1967.
How does Peter rate that possibility?
As a possibility, but nothing more.
So then he hired Kiever.
He started the process.
Searching online?
At first.
Reacher said, tell us about his interest in the Internet. But then the daughter came back in the room to tell her mom people were leaving. The two of them went out together to say goodbye, and Reacher heard the outside hubbub change in frequency to a long, slow goodbye tone, and then he heard car doors slamming and engines starting and vehicles pulling away. 5 minutes later, the house was absolutely silent. No one came back to the shuttered study. Reacher and Chang waited alone in the gloom. 5 more minutes. Nothing doing. They opened the door and looked out. An interior hallway. Empty. Silver-framed photographs on the wall. A family story in chronological order. A couple with a baby, a couple with an infant, a couple with a kid, a couple with a teenager, all three of them growing older frame by frame. There was no sound, no voices, no footsteps. They moved out of the study to the hallway. They felt entitled, or allowed, or at least no longer inappropriate. The guests were gone, no more need to hide. They turned toward what they felt was the center of the house and took quiet, tentative steps. The silver-framed photographs started up again, a fresh batch in a new location, but the same old story. A couple with a college student, a couple with a muddy college student in a soccer uniform holding a cup, a couple with a graduating college student. No voices, no footsteps. They moved on, past a room with padded walls and a giant screen and a forest of upright loudspeakers, and three separate chairs, each one of them with its own reclining mechanism and its own cup holder. A home theater. Richard had never seen one before, in a home. No sound. They came out in an arched antechamber ahead of the living room, where the architecture changed from adobe to hunting lodge. The ceiling soared overhead, with knotty boards rising to an angled peak in a shallow, upside-down V. Black iron chandeliers hung down with bulbs made to look like candles. There were sofas made of thick brown leather, deep and wide and sprawling, with plaid blankets folded over their backs for color. They heard a car on the driveway. Metallic thumps as doors opened and closed, footsteps on the rivers of stone. The front door opened, a heavy tread in the hallway. Dr. Evan Lair walked into his living room. He saw Reacher, saw Chang, and stopped. He said, "Hey, guys," in a way that was part welcome, part question. Perfectly amiable, completely accepting, but with a tiny edge of impatience, as if what he really meant was, "I thought all the guests had gone." Then his daughter came in behind him, still in the shirt and bikini, and she put her hand on his back and said,
"It's something to do with Cousin Michael. Mama's been talking to them."
Then she maneuvered onward and stepped up close and put out her hand and said,
"Hi. I'm Emily."
And they all shook and introduced themselves and said congratulations all around. Then McCann's sister came in, kind of dusting her hands, and she said,
"I'm sorry, but we took a slice of cake and a glass of tea to the man at the gate. The least we could do. He had a busy afternoon on our behalf."
Reacher said, "Did you give him a guest list beforehand?"
"We have to."
"Then you should have given him only half a slice of cake. He let us in without checking it." Evan said, "Is Michael still missing?" Emily said,
"Dad, you know he is."
"And Peter is finally looking for him now? Is that what this is?"
Uncle Peter has been looking for him all along.
Well, he isn't here. Neither one of them is here. Reacher said, "We apologize for the intrusion."
"Sit down," Emily said. "Please."
They ended up 2 and 3 on opposite sofas, Reacher and Chang cradled in the corners of one, with iced tea in glasses, on coasters, on coffee tables made to look like old steamship trunks. And across from them, on the other sofa, was the Lair family, all in a line, with Evan and Lydia at the ends and Emily in the middle, long and lithe and golden tan. Reacher said, "Peter did very well with the phone company. That kind of information is hard to get." Peter's sister said,
"It's Chicago. It was a friend of a friend in the Union."
"And Peter being a thorough guy, he won't have summarily dismissed the phone theft scenarios before or after the train ride in Tulsa or O.C. or Chicago. Not completely out of hand, but he will have thought it at least equally likely something happened along the way."
"On the train?"
Emily said. "Or not. We know that train as it happens. It stops once before Chicago, at a little country place called Mother's Rest."
No reaction from McCann's sister. Reacher said, "Mother's Rest is way out in the middle of nowhere. It's also Kiever's last known location. I think Peter concluded Michael got out of the train there. Hence, his phone never came out the other side of the dead zone. I think he sent Kiever to check."
"Well, that's good, right?" Evans said. "If he's there, Kiever will find him."
Reacher said nothing. McCann's sister said,
"He's had no luck yet. Peter hasn't had a report in 3 days. Nothing doing. Unless he's due to call me with the good news right about now,"
which seemed to make her conscious of the time, because she patted her wrist, looking for a watch, and then she squinted far into the kitchen to see the microwave clock. She said,
"It's after supper time in Chicago."
She pointed near Reacher and said,
"Hon, pass me the phone."
The phone was on the steamer trunk near his iced tea. It was bigger than some, and curvier and heavier. Better plastic. Still cordless and modern, but first generation. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It had a transparent window for speed dial labels, with a space at the top for its own number, which someone had filled out in elegant pencil, the 480 area code and 7 more digits. He passed it across, and McCann's sister took it
and checked it for a dial tone.
She said,
"The line is working."
Evan asked,
"How big of a place is Mother's Rest?"
Reacher said, "Very small."
"Why is it called that?"
"No one knows."
"How can it take 3 days to search a very small place?"
"Depends how thorough you are. You could spend 3 weeks poking around, opening every door, looking under every bush, which is what's on my mind. It's a footsore picture. It's old-fashioned police work. The phone company trace, through a pal in the Union, the railroad schedules, the guess about whether he stayed on board or got out, the physical search of a physical location, time and space, steel and iron, shoe leather and late nights. Smart people would call it analog."
"I suppose sometimes it has to be that way."
"But we heard Peter was obsessed with the Internet. He called a science journalist in L.A. a total of 18 times to talk about it."
"Was that separate? How is that connected to a place that doesn't even get cell service?"
McCann's sister said,
"It wasn't separate. It was parallel. He thought it might be a clue to where Michael was. He thought that Michael might talk to similar people on secret sites. Maybe he was heading somewhere for a reason. Maybe there had been discussions. We had high hopes of Mr. Westwood for a time. He might have held the key, but Peter was very persistent, and persistence can be a negative thing in the end. As you say, 18 calls. I tried to warn him.
Did he find the sights, anyway?
McCann's sister said, I'll get more tea.
She stood up and picked up the jug from the steamer trunk, and the jug caught the phone and sent it spinning in place, frictionless, plastic on leather. Reacher saw the neat pencil handwriting rotating slowly like a bicycle spoke coming to rest. Area code 480 and 7 more digits. Phoenix, Arizona. Where we're going. We're on the way. The time for looking over your shoulder starts now. Half a slice of cake. He said, Evan, may I ask you a personal question? Dr. Lair did what most guys do when facing such an inquiry, which was to pause a quizzical beat and shrug in mock innocence and say, Sure. Do you keep a gun in the house?
Is that important?
Just a matter of interest.
As a matter of fact, I do.
May I see it?
That's a strange request.
His daughter Emily was half turned sideways, sitting cross-legged, watching the exchange back and forth from one face to the other, like tennis. So was Chang. Reacher said, Is the gun in the bedroom? Lair said,
As a matter of fact, it is.
It would be better in the hallway. Dead of night home invasions are rare. Plus, you'd be too sleepy to be effective. Are you right-handed?
Yes, I am.
Then, within 6 feet of the front door on the right-hand side would be favorite, in a drawer or a cabinet, or grips up in a decorative vase. On a table, I imagine that would work.
Are you also a security consultant?
We aim to offer a wide range of services. Emily said,
He's right, Dad. The bedroom is pointless.
Chang said,
Technically, our advice would be to conceal a separate firearm in each major zone of the house. The bedroom, certainly, but also the kitchen area, the living area, the entrance lobby, upstairs, if you have one, the basement, if you have one, and the garage.
Emily said,
Where's best if you only have one?
Only have one, Reacher heard.
Go with the math, Chang said. Most problems come in the front door.
Seriously? Lair said. I should move it?
Better ask Mom, Emily said.
And right then, McCann's sister came back with a fresh jug of tea and cake on a plate, and she said,
Ask me what? Whether my daddy should move his gun to the hallway? Why on earth would he want to do that? On the advice of one logical daughter and two security consultants, how on earth did the subject come up? Is it important?
We can't tell her. Not now. Reacher said, No, it was just professional interest, that's all. And a minute later, the matter evaporated like a bubble of soap, quickly forgotten, except by Chang, who flashed a question, eye to eye. What the hell is going on? Reacher scratched his nose, absently, with the edge of his forefinger, the rest of his hand cupped below, hiding him, mouthing, Turn your phone off. McCann's sister said,
Are you okay?
Reacher said, Tell us about the websites Michael was using. Chapter 40. McCann learned two things fast, his sister said, when he started looking at his son's computer. The first was that software could be booby-trapped so that opening an internet history was the same thing as erasing an internet history, unless you opened it right, which he didn't, obviously, because he didn't know how. But like a lot of downloaded programs, it wasn't perfect. It had a tiny glitch. It left the first screen visible for about half a second. Then it was gone. Blank. No more.
The second thing he learned was how short of a time half a second was, but also how long. A fastball could get there and back again in half a second, easy, and plenty could be retained in the memory. It was a question of trusting, not thinking. Some ancient trick of mind and retina and afterimage. Better to look away and glimpse it on the edge. Except it meant nothing. Just long lines of characters, as if someone had rolled a ball along the top part of a keyboard. Completely random. McCann's sister said,
"So, Peter, being Peter, he learned what he could about what he was up against, which turned out to be the deep web, about which there wasn't much useful to learn. We had some scary conversations. We thought we were in charge, relatively speaking, but we weren't. There was a whole secret world we knew nothing about. It was 10 times bigger than ours. People were in there, talking, doing weird stuff we wouldn't understand. It was like a science fiction movie."
Reacher said, "Was there one thing in particular Westwood was supposed to help with, or was it a general inquiry?"
"No, it was very specific. There's a widespread feeling among deep web people that the government must be building a search engine capable of finding their websites. We felt there was a hint in Westwood's article that it already exists. Peter wants Westwood to confirm or deny, and if so, help get him a chance to use it."
"Is that likely?"
"Personally, I don't think there's a hope in hell. But leave no stone unturned. His son is missing. My nephew."
"Is it conceivable Peter could have left things out when he was talking to you? Were his stories always completely joined up?"
"What do you mean?"
"You hadn't heard the words Mother's Rest, for instance."
"No, I hadn't."
"Did he ever say anything about 200 deaths?
Emily said, "200 what?"
Her mother said,
"No."
Reacher said, "He talked to Kiever about both those things, and Kiever went to Mother's Rest, so it was important somehow. Yet he didn't mention it to you."
"What happens there?"
"We don't know."
"Peter's my big brother, and I'm his little sister. He never forgets it. Never lets me forget it either. Not in a bad way. In the best way. The only reason he would leave things out would be to spare me unpleasantness."
No one spoke. Chang got up. She said,
"I need the ladies' room."
And Emily pointed it out, and she wandered away in the right direction. Reacher said, "Do you guys have plans for dinner?"
McCann's sister said, "I haven't thought about it yet."
"We could go out."
"Who?"
"All of us."
"Where?"
"Anywhere you like. Right now, my treat. Let me take you out to dinner."
"Why?"
"Sounds like you've been working hard all day." Chang reappeared at the edge of the living room. She caught Reacher's eye and said,
"Men's room is right here, if you need it."
He said, "Okay."
"I can show you, if you like."
"I'm sure I'll find it when the time is right." Emily said,
"She wants to talk to you in private."
So Reacher got up and joined Chang in the outer hallway. She said quietly,
"You think Hackett's friends are coming?"
"We should have been more cautious with the phone. They could have equipment all over the country. If so, we just sold out the sister. We gave Westwood chapter and verse, so we can't leave them alone, not here, not now. Either we get them out or we babysit them all night. Close personal protection. A wide range of services."
"I'd rather get them out."
"I already offered them dinner."
"The guy in the gate is useless."
"Which way is the bedroom?"
"The other wing. Through the living room again."
"You try asking them the dinner. Maybe they thought it was weird from me.
It's weird from either one of us. We don't know them. And they're in the middle of a high-precision wedding countdown. Two strangers suddenly taking them out for a bucket of chicken would make their heads explode.
I said anywhere they want. Doesn't have to be KFC.
Same difference. Doesn't matter where we go.
They heard a car on the driveway. Metallic thumps as doors opened and closed. Footsteps on the rivers of stone. Modern automotive design puts no more than four seats behind regular wide-open doors. Some sedans might be five-seaters, and some trucks were seven-seaters, but no tough guy grows up wanting to sit on the transmission hump, and no one is effective in the way back of a minivan. So worst case would be four incoming. Best case would be one. Likelihood was either two or three. Reacher turned instantly and headed across the living room, charting his course many steps ahead, as straight as possible, setting himself to graze the corners of tables and the arms of chairs like a downhill slalom against the clock. The Lair family was still all in line on the sofa, frozen, not understanding. Lydia, Emily, Evan. The linen shift, the shirt and bikini, the shorts and the loud Hawaiian, all watching. So Reacher patted the air as he passed them by, telling them to stay where they were, and then he hustled onward, out the far side of the living room, into a short hallway, past more silver-framed photographs of unknown people, maybe relatives, including a thin man and a sad boy, perhaps Peter and Michael McCann. And finally, onward into the bedroom. The back of his brain said, "Women usually take the side near the bathroom," and he sidestepped and scrambled around a pillow-stacked king-size bed to a night table with nothing on it but an alarm clock and an unread book. He heard them kick down the front door. He wrenched open the drawer under the book and saw reading glasses and headache pills and a box of tissues and a Colt Python with a 6-inch barrel, hatched walnut grips lacquered to a soupy shine, an immense blued steel frame, brawny 357 Magnum rounds in the wheel, one hell of a nighttime gun, smart in some ways, no complexity, no safety, no jams, but dumb in other ways. It weighed 3 pounds. Too heavy to lift while blinking awake, and the recoil would blow a sleepy arm through the headboard. Reacher took it and checked the cylinder. All there. A 6-shooter. 6 rounds. He heard boots in the hallway, inside the front door, moving 6 feet to the right. 2 people. A third would be coming around the back. If there was a third, along the decorative path, past the plantings, between the solar lights, through the gate. Please go in. No spare rounds in the drawer. A 6-shooter. Reacher stepped back to the bedroom door. Still he heard boots in the hallway. Then he moved out, past the silver-framed photographs again, edging sideways, Python at arm's length, eyes on the front sight, crisp and clear. Everything else blurred, the light soft, the house shuttered and shaded against the sun, and full of dim shadows. He stopped at the mouth of the living room. On his left was the Lair family, still on the sofa, but starting to stir. Shock was giving way to fear, and in Emily's case, outrage. She was going to break forward. Her folks were going to break back. On his right was the sofa he and Chang had sat on, and beyond it was a partial view to the door. He saw the bulk of a moving shoulder, a silhouette against the light, tense and pumped up and ready to go. On his left, through the slider, he saw a guy in the backyard, behind the wedding gifts, then out in clear air, black T-shirt, black pants,
and a Ruger P-85 with a suppressor tube fitted. Carried easy, down by his side, from above his knee to the top of his boot, which was also black. They were dressed the part. That was for damn sure. Where was Chang? Reacher did not want to fire without knowing where she was. Not a magnum round. Not in her general direction. Too many dim shadows. Too much dazzling contrast. Too many crazy outcomes. Rounds could deflect off bone and go through walls. Plural. They could exit the building completely and break a window down the street. Where was she? Emily was drawing breath, ready to start yelling and screaming, bikini and all. In Reacher's view, a natural primeval reaction, the instinctive defense of family and territory. Plus, in her case, a measure of righteous indignation, as in, this was her special week, and who the hell did they think they were, anyway? Evan was a calm man, accustomed to calamity, trained in science and reason, in tests and evidence and careful diagnosis. And he was a smart guy, and all his circuits were sparking, but he couldn't make anything fit in his mind. So his body was left waiting for a final decision. Lydia was pressed back in her corner, the wife and mother, the sister and the aunt, retreating into herself, Reacher thought, or into an earlier version of herself, perhaps the true McCann version, raised tougher, maybe in the kind of place where splintering wood and a heavy tread was never good news. Then the guy in the yard opened the slider and stepped inside, and the back of Reacher's brain showed him the whole chess game right there, laid out, obvious, like flashing neon arrows, in immense and grotesque detail. The snap, pivot left, and the round into the meat of the yard guy's chest, where it was less likely than a headshot to go through and through, which was good, given a neighborhood behind them full of wooden fences, but where it was more likely to soak the Lair family with thick pink mist from behind, hair and all, which wasn't good, because it would be traumatic, especially during such a week. Except, on reflection, Reacher figured the week was already pretty much a disaster from that exact point onward, given that the chess game said there would be a dead guy at that very moment sliding to the floor of their private house, even as the homeowner-owned python was snapping right again for two rounds at where the silhouette of the shoulder had been, which two rounds might or might not hit anything, but which would give a second's cover for the scramble around the sofa and the capture of the dead guy's Ruger, for a total of 3 rounds expended and 15 gained. But Reacher made none of those shots or moves, because by then he knew where Chang was. She was being pushed into view, toward the living room, from the front door, struggling. Two guys holding her, her hands trapped behind her back, a palm clamped over her mouth, a gun at her head. Another Ruger, with another suppressor. Unstable and unwieldy in its present role because of its length, but no doubt effective. Reacher put the python on the floor behind him, very quietly, in the shadows against the hallway baseboard, under the last of the silver-framed photographs. Then he stepped into the living room. Chapter 41. The guy from the yard tracked around part of a curve, and the two from the door came in and took up position on the same arc, wide apart. Chang suddenly shoved forward, sent sprawling, all the way to the Lair's sofa, where she landed and steadied herself and turned around and perched on the edge. Reacher sat on the arm, slow and casual, wanting to look like less of a threat, wanting to anchor himself at that end of the room, knowing a standing guy will be told to sit, and often where, whereas a sitting guy was rarely moved.
Evan was next to him, and then came Emily, sitting back, and Chang, sitting forward and breathing hard, and Lydia, sitting back. What had been spacious for three was crowded for five. They made a unified target. Three Rugers against them, fanned out wide, like a field of fire diagram in an old infantry manual. Three Rugers, three guys. Black clothes, scalped hair, pale skin. Big enough and heavy enough, but also somehow bony. Tight cheekbones. Hard times in their DNA, from not too long ago. From Europe, maybe. Far in the marshy east. Every man against his neighbor for the last 1,000 years. They stood there, rock steady, at first calming down and taking stock and checking boxes, and then thinking hard about something new. Normally, Reacher might have said they looked like they knew what they were doing, but the truth was right then he thought they didn't. Not 100%. Not anymore. They were improvising, or preparing to improvise, or at least considering it, as if their own chess game had come to a fork in the road. Arrows to the left, arrows to the right. Options. Freedom of choice. Always dangerous. They didn't move, didn't speak. There was maybe a hint of a smile. Then the guy in the middle said, "We were told we would find a man and a woman talking to another woman." Good English, close to a regular American accent, but with dull Slavic undertones. Eastern Europe, for sure. Moody, put upon, a guy whose life was a sea of troubles. No one answered. The guy said, "But what we actually find is two men and three women, one of which is Chinese, which is all very confusing. So tell me, which among you has been talking to who?" Chang said, "I'm American, not Chinese, and we've all been talking to each other, everyone to everyone else, always around. Now you tell us something. Who the hell are you, and what the hell are you doing here?" The guy said, "One of you is somebody's sister." No response. The guy said, "We don't know if the somebody is a Chinaman. That information would have helped, I guess." No response. "Which one of you is somebody's sister?"
"Not me," Reacher said.
"You got a sister, wise guy? Maybe you should tell me where she lives."
"If I had a sister, I would. Save me kicking your ass myself."
The guy looked away to the other end of the sofa, to the three women there. He said,
"Which one of you is the sister?"
No response.
"Which one of you is the woman who spoke to the sister?"
No response. The guy looked back the other way. He said,
"Which one of you is the man who spoke to the sister?"
No response. The guy said,
"There are many combinations, like a test at the Institute of Mathematics. How many socks do I need to guarantee a pair? But in this case, one answer at least is obvious, even to the dullest student. We could kill you all. That would guarantee the correct result. That would be a sufficiently large number of socks. But it would be 5 dead for the price of 3. And that price was agreed up front. Count your change before you leave the store. No renegotiation after the fact. Those are the fat man's rules."
Silence. The guy looked at Evan and said, "What do you do for a living?" Evan started once and started again and got it out third time around. He said,
"I'm a doctor."
"Do you work for free?"
"No, I guess I don't." "Dumb question, right? Doctors working for free?"
"Some doctors work for free."
"But not you, right?"
"No, I guess not."
Do you think I should work for free? Evan breathed in, breathed out, floundering. The guy said, Doctor, it's a simple question. I'm not seeking a medical opinion. Do you think I should work for free when you don't? Does it matter what I think? I want us all to be comfortable. I want us all to agree a person should get paid for the work he does. I need your backing on this.
Okay, a person should get paid. For what?
For the work he does. Should he get more for five things than three things?
I guess he should.
But how can he when the price was fixed up front? There is no more blood in that stone, which is bad news for us, but good news for you. We'll do only what we've been paid to do. No free samples. You stand a chance of surviving.
A 40% chance, the back of Reacher's brain told him, immediately and automatically, if the shooting was random. But why would the shooting be random? Their brief was a man and two women. In which case, Evan's odds rose to 50-50, and Chang's fell from 40% to 33%. The guy said,
Of course, the flaw in the plan is we might leave the wrong two alive, which would not be acceptable. I'm sure you have professional standards of your own. The problem needs to be solved another way. We need to think laterally. We need to find a way to get paid. Help me out here.
Evan said, There's no money in the house.
Doctor, I'm not asking a man to pay for his own execution. That would be harsh. I'm asking you to think laterally. What is there in the current situation that could provide some element of recompense for me and my partners?
Evan said nothing.
Be creative, doctor. Loosen up. Think outside the box. If not money, what else?
No answer. The guy looked at Emily and said,
What's your name, sweetheart?
Evan said, No. The guy looked at Chang. He said,
Her too.
Emily pulled her shirt tight around her and drew up her knees and scrabbled backward on the sofa. Evan leaned in front of her. The guy in the middle stared him down and said,
If you behave yourself, we'll shoot you first. If you don't, we'll leave you alive and make you watch.
The three guys were equally spaced along the rim of a quarter circle, like the bases loaded, but much closer. They were in a room, after all, not a ballpark. A spacious room, but still. The guy at first base on the right was maybe 7 feet from Reacher. At third, on the far left, the furthest guy was 15 feet away, and the guy on second was halfway between the other two, doing all the talking on a straight line between Reacher and the front door, about 12 feet distant. Three guys. No doubt the Maricopa County DA would call them invaders, as in, a home invasion turned tragic tonight in an exclusive gated community northeast of town. Film at 11. The cops would call them perpetrators. Their lawyers would call them clients. Politicians would call them scum. Criminologists would call them sociopaths. Sociologists would call them misunderstood. The 110th MP would call them dead men walking. The guy on second said,
Let's get this show on the road.
Emily was wedged hard against the back of the sofa, pressed against the plaid wool blanket, her knees drawn up,
her arms wrapped tight around her shins. Altogether, she looked like a person half her size. Chang wasn't going anywhere either. She was planted in place, her hands flat on the sofa by her sides, her legs out straight, her lace-up shoes way out in front of her, her heels literally dug into the rug, like a cartoon roadrunner skidding to a stop. The guy on second said,
"I'm getting impatient here."
Wet lips, moving eyes, urgent. No response. Then Reacher breathed out and raised a placatory "Don't shoot" palm, and he half stood, slow and calm, unthreatening, the complete opposite of sudden, and he kept himself half turned away from the guys with the guns and half turned toward the group on the sofa, and he said, "Come on, Emily, let's get this done. They're going to nail you one way or the other. Might as well make it easy on yourself." She said,
"What?"
He leaned past Evan and grabbed the kid's wrist and pulled her upright. Immediately, Evan stood up to fight him, and Chang, too, and McCann's sister, all of them breathless and panicked and unbelieving. Suddenly, there was a small knot of people, all vertical and active, clustered together on the rug between the sofas, moving, swaying, bumping, glancing desperately left and right. The moment of truth. The three guys did nothing. Their smart play at that point would have been to start blasting away, there and then, no hesitation, recognizing that the situation was turning to shit right in front of their eyes. But by then they were heavily invested in a plan of their own devising, in a course of action, in a procedure, in the promise of extreme future physical pleasure, and the two major components of that coming nirvana were knotted tight in the swaying crowd, collateral damage just waiting to happen. And they didn't want them damaged. Not so soon. They wanted them just the way they were, whole, aware, reacting, all smooth, tan flesh in bikinis and T-shirts and low-cut jeans. So they didn't shoot. They didn't think. Not with their brains, anyway. So far, so good. Reacher nudged Evan one way and Chang the other and pulled Emily out of the crowd. He reeled her in, all thrashing knees and elbows, and he turned her around and shoved her onward, hard, into the hallway with the silver-framed photographs of the unknown relatives. He said, "The bedroom is that way." Evan scrambled past him, grabbing at his daughter, and McCann's sister jostled him almost as quick, and Chang piled in behind her, with the first base guy following, some sudden concern on his face about the emerging chaos. And behind him, the second base spokesperson crowded in, with the third base guy coming in from the rear. Eight people in total, clumsy, stumbling, forced nearly to single file, funneling into a dark, narrow hallway. Reacher dropped down in the crowd and scooped up the python, two-handed to stop it skittering on the polished wood, and he snugged the butt in his palm, solid and reassuring, and he fit his finger in the guard, against the trigger, hard and substantial, and he brought the gun up, 3 pounds of weight, and he put his left hand on the top of Lydia Lair's head and buckled her knees and forced her down, and he aimed over Chang's right shoulder and fired at the center of the man on first's face. There were many factors that made a handgun either accurate or not accurate. The velocity of the round and the length of the barrel were the most important, aided or not by aerodynamic subtleties like the degree of spin imparted by the rifling grooves, which either worked well or didn't, depending on the bullet. Precision of manufacture was influential, with careful machining of quality metal much preferred over casting from leftover slag. Not that anything much mattered at 7 feet. A pore to the left or a wrinkle to the right was immaterial. The human face was a big enough target, generally hard to miss at close quarters, and the man on firsts was no exception. It was a through and through, obviously,
given the short range and the power of the magnum round. 20 feet behind the guy's head, the wall instantly cratered, the size of a punch bowl, and a ghastly split second later, the contents of the guy's brain pan arrived to fill it with a wet slap, all red and gray and purple. Meanwhile, the guy himself was going down vertically, as if he had stepped into an elevator shaft, and Reacher was turning fractionally left from the waist, shoulders braced, looking for the third base guy the furthest away, because some back-of-the-brain calculation was telling him the guy had a better line of return fire, and he wasn't drooling as bad as the second base guy, so maybe he was less invested in the upcoming entertainment, and therefore more likely to start blasting, even at the risk of damaged goods. Reacher eased the trigger home, and he felt the mechanism turn, gears and cams and levers effortless, and the gun fired, in his mind a considered shot, a decent interval after his first, but in the real world, almost a double tap, a fast bang move, bang, a craftsman going about his business calmly, using his natural-born gifts. It was a through and through again, inevitably, in the guy's upper lip, out the base of his skull, shattering the slider window and exploding a pile of wedding presents on the table in the yard outside, in a cloud of paper fragments, white and silver, like confetti a few days early. The broken glass came down like a waterfall, governed by gravity, and therefore at the same downward speed as the third base guy, who was also governed by gravity. Reacher saw an inch of their synchronized descent, and then he whipped away to the right to find the second base guy, because at that point the race was really on, and Reacher was losing. One guy was nothing, and two guys were never really a problem either, but a third guy could get tricky. The bang, bang of his pals going down tended to concentrate his mind, and worse than that, gave him time to get his head in the game, to react, to finally realize, oh, yeah, I've got a gun in my hand, to bring the gun up, slower than usual because of the fat suppressor tube, because the gun was twice as long as his muscle memory thought it was, and also heavier, and therefore less controllable, which was all good, because his traverse was a whole lot shorter than Reacher's needed to be. He was almost there already, just inches away, game almost over. But Reacher kept on moving in what felt like hopeless slow motion, like forcing the back of his hand through molasses on a cold winter's day, his left eye on the python's front sight, his right eye on the hole in the end of the suppressor tube, which was still elliptical, but only slightly. It was an inch away from dead on. The python was a foot away from dead on. Reacher chopped it downward, like cracking a whip backhand, mainly for extra speed and power, but also because the guy was widest at the shoulders, and aiming was a luxury Reacher could no longer afford. The python was a double-action weapon, which meant the same trigger pull cocked the hammer and then dropped it, so he started early, getting the cylinder turning while the gun was still moving, seeing the hammer come up, feeling the cams and the levers, waiting, then firing, trusting millisecond timing and momentum and deflection and complex four-dimensional calculations. In other words, a wing and a prayer. But it worked, apparently, because the guy didn't fire back, and a red chunk came out of his neck, big enough to feed a family. A triple play, unassisted. Baseball immortality. Behind the guy, the bullet smashed its way in and out of a powder room and shattered a lamp in the hallway. The guy himself went down in a heap with what should have been a thump and a clatter, but Reacher heard none of it, because a magnum's downside was deafness, at least temporary, especially inside. Around him, the others were helpless with shock,
as if frozen in place by a camera strobe or a flash of lightning. McCann's sister was on her knees, her mouth wide open in a scream Reacher couldn't hear, and Emily was crouched against the base of the hallway wall. Understandable. A magnum inside was like a stun grenade, three times. Then the hiss and the roar dulled a little, and people started moving. Chang went for Emily, and Evan helped his wife up and then shouldered his way through for a look at the living room, whereupon he turned around and started herding people back toward the bedroom again, shaking his head emphatically, saying, "We can't go in there," over and over again. Not because of personal discomfort, Reacher supposed, the guy being a doctor and so on, but to spare his family the sight, although he supposed they had been in a butcher's shop and survived the experience, although three guys was a lot of dead meat. Or maybe he was worried about crime scene integrity. Too much TV. The Lair family sat on the bed, smaller somehow, except for their eyes, all of them panting hard, all of them trying to hold it together. Chang paced. Reacher wiped the big old Colt and left it on Evan Lair's nightstand. Lair said, "We should call the police. We have a legal responsibility." Chang said, "Yes, sir. That would be my advice. You need to get out in front of this." McCann's sister said, "Peter's dead, isn't he?" No answer. "They got him, and now they came to get me, because they think I know what he knows, or knew. Everyone thinks that. That's what you think." Chang said, "We have no proof or first-hand evidence about Peter. It would be most improper for us to tell you anything, and Michael must be told first anyway. I expect he's dead, too. We have no information." The room went quiet. Then Evans said, "What are we going to do?" Reacher said, "About what?" "We have dead people in our house." "They won't come out smelling of roses, so they'll call it a righteous shooting, a home invasion, silenced weapons, threats of sexual violence. We're not going to jail over this. We're going to get a pat on the head instead. Except I don't really care for that kind of thing. I would be just as happy not to be mentioned at all, like I wasn't here. You should take the credit. Play around with the gun. Get your prints on it again. They'll give you a free year at the country club. You'll get new patients. The badass doc."
"Are you serious?"
"I don't care how it turns out. They'll never find me. But I would appreciate a head start. Miss Chang and I have a lot to do. It would help us if you would sit tight for about 30 minutes before you call 911. Tell them any story you want. Tell them you were in shock, hence the delay."
30 minutes,
Evan said. "Shock can last that long."
"Okay.
But when it comes to the story, tell them only two of them had guns."
"Why?"
"Because I'm going to take one with me, and some cops can count that high."
"Okay. 30 minutes. Two guns. If I can. I'm not good with uniforms."
Reacher looked at Emily and said, "Ma'am, I'm very sorry your big week got ruined." Emily said,
"I owe you my thanks."
"Think nothing of it." He headed out behind Chang, who stopped to hug McCann's sister and to say in response to her mute inquiries,
"I'm very sorry for your loss."
Then they closed the door on them and headed down the hallway, past the photographs, to the living room. First up was the first base guy, but he had collapsed at an awkward angle. His suppressor was in the pool of blood coming from what was left of his head, and suppressors have wadding inside, or very fine baffles, either one of which would leak blood forever, so they passed the guy by. The third base guy was a detour, so Chang ducked down to the second base guy, the guy who had done all the talking, and she scooped up his Ruger, white collar or not, and then she stopped. She whispered,
"Reacher, this one is still breathing."